brought to you by Black Knight. It's the technology.ie podcast, episode 24 for April 13th, 2012, with Michaela Nealon and Conor Muinichon. Yes, Mariva, it's Keith Falter of Ishtach. Hello and welcome to the technology.ie podcast. My name's Conor Muinichon in the technology.ie podcast studio. And on the internet, we contact Michaela Nealon. Is the spirit of Michaela out there?
I don't know about the spirit, but I'm here anyway.
Good man yourself, Michaela. Via Skype, joining us on the podcast this evening. Michaela Nealon, CEO of Black Knight, and thanks for joining us. Lots to talk about on the show this week. Instagram, oh my God, what is going on there? $1 billion. And speaking of a billion, that's what Red Hat have turned over in annual turnover at this stage. And that is a milestone for them. Max attacked. We'll be talking about the virus and botnet and Trojan attack on Apple's. It seems they're not as safe as some people would like us to believe. Google Plus gets a new look, and we'll talk about lots more stuff as well. A little bit later this week, it's a bank holiday week, 4-day week. We were pressed for time this week, and Michaela, you couldn't make it to record last night. You went to the movies instead.
Yeah, I kind of feel a bit guilty about that.
Nah, don't
worry. But only that guilt lasted for about 10 seconds.
I was delighted you cancelled. I was absolutely up the walls busy. What did you go and see?
I went to see Battleship.
What is that?
It's, what's the term that a friend uses? Brain candy. it's a big action movie. It's one of those big Hollywood blockbusters. It's got, you know, amazing special effects, lots of action. And it's one of those films that, you know, it's pure escapism.
Oh, wow, it looks good here. I'm just IMDBing it here. A fleet of ships is forced to do battle with an armada of unknown origins, directed by Peter Berg. Who's in it? Oh, Liam Neeson.
Yeah, Liam Neeson. Now, he's not one of the main characters. He's one of the, I mean, how can you put him? He's one of the
principal
characters, but he's not one of the lead character.
He's got top billing here, but it's...
He's got top billing. For God's sake, the man's won Oscars, hasn't
he's
he?
He's an admiral, so he is.
He is indeed.
And Taylor Kitsch, what a name. He's the new action hero, isn't he? And Rihanna is in it.
Ah, but never mind Rihanna. I mean, look who else is in it.
Who else? I must have a look down.
Ah, come on, come on.
I can't read it fast enough. Fill me in.
Brooklyn Decker.
I don't know her. Who's she?
Okay, now Brooklyn Decker is, well, she's an aspiring actress, but she's probably better known as being a swimsuit model.
All right. Okay. Very good. As you said, eye candy, brain candy, lots of fun, and a good night out.
Oh yeah, I mean it's one of those films. I mean, it's not going to win any. Well, it might win an Oscar or something like that for, you know, something oblique like, you know, best use of a mouse trap in a motion picture or something. You know, one of those kind of crazy awards.
You know, I'm just too old, Michaela. I'm just not with the latest stuff that's going on, and that's a bit like how I feel about Instagram as well. What on earth is going on? Okay. Now, I remember years ago, was it Google paid $1.6 billion for YouTube at the time? And people were saying, what on earth is YouTube? You know, and a lot of people who were, you know, anyone who was vaguely connected to the internet said, oh, yeah, good move. Goodbye. Wait a second. Instagram. We're talking about what? Photo sharing, mobile app. What's the story?
I mean, it's an app which up until, I think it's like up until last week, it was only available for the iPhone. It wasn't available for Android.
Yeah.
And all it really seems to do is it allows you to take a photograph, which you can do with your phone anyway. You can apply a few filters to it so that it kind of, you know, can get that sepia toned look or whatever.
Yeah, and this seems to be one of the sort of hipster things about it. You can take a picture and have it look like it was taken with an Instamatic in the 1970s or 80s. It has that kind of tone of a lot of the stuff you see people post. Okay, lovely, but really? I mean,
yeah, I mean, I just can't understand it. I mean, the news broke, I think it was on Sunday. Sunday the news broke.
Yeah,
was that Sunday or Monday? And you know, Twitter, Facebook, and various other social networks. I mean, it just took over completely. Mm. And you know, I predicted that there was going to be a hell of a lot written about it, a hell of a lot said about it over the coming days and weeks. And nobody has yet to come up with a plausible explanation as to why anybody would pay that much money for it. So I think one of the funniest comments I saw...
Not only is it not profitable, it doesn't even earn any revenue.
Yeah, there's no revenue stream whatsoever. None.
Go on, what were you saying, one of the best comments you saw on it?
Well, the best comments I saw was, why did Facebook pay $1 billion? Yes. Because Google offered $750 million. Yeah. I thought to myself, okay, Google were offering less. So, Facebook upped the bid.
Shh. Can you hear it? The bubble.
Oh, it's about to burst, isn't it?
Yeah. What?
I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, some of the arguments that people have put forward are about, the users, getting the users that Facebook wants to dominate.
It's only got 30 million users.
Well, this is it. It doesn't make any logical sense to me. I mean, it's not as if it's the only one out there. It's not the only show in town. Why would you pay so much for that if it has absolutely no revenue?
I mean, for example, some people are saying, look at this. Yahoo is floundering. They're laying off 2,000 people. People are wondering what's going to happen to Flickr. Flickr could be Instagram. Flickr has so much more to offer in so many ways, so much more of a community, so much more going on. Instagram shows up and within no time at all, it's worth $1 billion. It doesn't make any sense.
Well, no, it doesn't. It doesn't make any sense at all. And okay, I mean, I would, a lot of people go, well, that's absolutely fantastic. It's great news for the guys behind Instagram. Well done to them. And, that's about the best thing you can say is if you were the one who had come up with Instagram and you'd managed to sell it for $1 billion, you'd be laughing all the way to the bank.
Yeah, it's more fun, Michele, when we disagree on things, but I think we're on the same side in relation to this. I'll get you back in a minute. I'll start mocking you about the Apple Mac virus. But no, there's no question. So seriously, is this a bubble, do you think? Have we finally reached the peak of irrational exuberance?
I don't know. I mean, it's something I see a lot of. I mean, you look at the stories people are talking about in TechCrunch, Mashable, Read Write Web and all these things, about all these really cool, hip, happening funky services and apps and everything else, but they're getting investments in millions and millions of dollars.
Are there others that you think are over the top?
Oh, there's a lot. There's a lot of them.
You get asked, don't you? Especially if you're anyway halfway technologically inclined, you get asked to sort of defend or explain, or very often I'd be invited onto say radio shows, and people would say, how can they justify this? And usually you can come up with some kind of an explanation, but not this time.
Not when there's no revenue involved. That's the bit that I don't get. I mean, it's like saying, and I mean, sure, this is something that, they've said a lot about a lot of different services is, you're buying the users and all that. But the problem I have with the Instagram thing is most of the users were sharing to Facebook anyway. So they already had Facebook accounts.
Yeah.
I mean, what exactly does that mean? That they're going to more tightly integrate Instagram into Facebook? Okay, fine. But what's that do? What's that do for anybody?
It's one of those where we kind of throw this open to the audience and we say, if we're missing something, myself and Michele here, please do let us know. Leave a comment on the site at technology.ie. I think we're just going around.
I would love for somebody
to
give me a real rational explanation as to why this is worth so much, because I don't get it.
Maybe if we used it, Michele, we might get it.
You have used it. I have used it, and it leaves me kind of scratching my head going, yeah, fine, handy and all that. But it's not even, I found it failed in a number of areas for me, because I can't say to you, here, Con, here's a link to all the photos I've uploaded to Instagram. I can't do that.
Right.
All it seems to do is create links to individual photos, which is, well, more than a little frustrating, because same with Flickr. I send you a link to my Flickr stream. You can see all my photos. I can send you a link to a Flickr album or a set or a collection. And, they've all these different terms for Flickr collections of photos. And, you can go there and go, right, these are all the photos. And you can go through, say, for example, if I got snaps from, I don't know, let's say I went on holiday somewhere and I've got a couple of hundred photos of Montenegro or something like that. You can look at all of them in one go. You can't do that with Instagram. Now, I can do that with Via Me, which I think we mentioned last week or something.
Yeah, and you is that your photo sharing site of choice at the moment?
It's one of them. I mean, I'm a bit fickle. I tend to kind of overshare. I share the same photos in multiple places. But I mean, with ViaMe, you can go to ViaMe.com/username. In my case, I'm Naylan, and you can see, well, you know, the random rubbish that I've uploaded via ViaMe. Mm. Sorry, but the name lends itself to that.
Yeah.
And you know, I can cross post it to Twitter. I can cross post it to Facebook if I want to. And sure, I've still got the photos, both the originals and the ones with the filter applied, on my phone, so I can import that into my computer and then upload it to wherever I want to afterwards.
And is that idea of applying filters to photographs and that, is that part of Via.me as well?
Oh yeah, of course it is. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And do you find that useful, or do you like that? Is it gimmicky?
It's a bit gimmicky. I mean, it's. I'm looking, like, if I were to look at the ones I've taken over the last couple of months.
Yeah.
like a couple of them, I suppose because of what I was taking a photograph of, applying a filter to it to give it that kind of sepia, black and white type effect would have worked. For other things, no, it doesn't. It doesn't bring anything. Yeah. Of any value. I mean, you're just kind of, you're applying a filter and yeah, so what? Who cares?
It's funny. I think that the whole notion of sort of being integrated with the tools you have and working with the stuff you have and being able to cross post easily and stuff like that is something that's of value. Something I'm going to get doing, I think I mentioned last week, I'm back in smartphone land after a couple of months of not really having anything useful in my pocket. I'm back on an Android phone again and already starting to take pictures, thinking about posting them to Google Plus because it's so easy to do so. Trying to get this thing working, and I had the same problem with my last Android phone as well. On Google Plus, there's this automatic upload feature. It'll upload every photograph that you take into a private folder on Google Plus for you, and you can then choose to share them or not. But the backup feature of that is something I find really, really useful, and it is something I'm interested in. That whole notion of being able to, I suppose, log your life, blog your life, not necessarily share it, but actually have that somewhere at hand. I think I'm actually going to be using Google Plus a little bit more, and they must have known that because they've prettied it up for me, Google Plus. Michele?
Yeah, I mean, the Google Plus thing, that took me by surprise. I mean, I logged in this morning, and I don't know, I think I was kind of logged off last night a bit, which is kind of odd for me, and I've missed out on all the happenings. I logged in this morning, I was completely confused.
I'm just looking, I've only seen it for the first time, and I'm not the greatest Google Plus user. I think I will be using it more, as I said, but it's... and already it's confusing me in terms of my multiple profiles and logins and stuff like that, so I can't actually log into it just now. But they've made it, it actually looks much better, a little bit confusing.
The thing that confused me first is because, I mean, I log in as both myself and as several pages.
Yes.
And I couldn't work out for the life of me how to switch from me to, you know, one of the pages.
Yes.
And it's hidden up on the top right-hand side of the page, beside the smaller version of your avatar.
Okay. Which is how it works with Gmail and other stuff as well, I think. And I've managed to log in now through Gmail. I think I'm getting into Google Plus here now, and just try and see what. And I haven't seen any press release or any commentary on this. Oh, but it is nicer, Michele.
The entire kind of interface now is a lot more integrated. It's more, I think I saw a couple of people talking about it saying it was much more Facebookish. In its style, which, that's a good thing or a bad thing is hard to say. But, I mean, it's easier to navigate once you get past kind of, okay, where the hell is that thing I actually need access to?
Yeah.
But, I mean, they're bringing things up to the top. Like, the trending on Google Plus is right there. So whereas before you had to go off and look for, I think it was like Hot on Google Plus or something like that. I know it's a much nicer interface. But it's still a little bit confusing, and you know, I suppose the other thing as well is it kind of assumes that you're going to do a lot more with it than you might actually want to.
You might actually be encouraged to, though, because it the way this is laid out somehow looks so much busier, suggests to you that there's a lot more going on in Google Plus. Just glancing at this now, it looks a bit more like Facebook in terms of all of the stuff that's going on. And I seem much more inclined now. It's funny, it's breaking things down by friends, family, And I'm not even sure I have circles called friends and... Oh, I do have circles called friends and family.
Well, I think they give them to you automatically.
Okay, yeah. And the rest of my circles are there as well. And you can... Now, this is good. You can browse your circles much more easily. You can choose to look at one circle or another, or indeed all of them as well. Yeah, I'm definitely going to be doing more. You do quite a bit on Google+, and by in saying that, I know, Michaela, you don't use it a lot, but you do tend to drop in there, and I know you promote the podcast through it as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing I do with most of these social networks is I'll wiggle my toes a little bit. And I suppose part of it is just to kind of see, you know, does that actually work? And if it only takes a couple of seconds to do us, well, then, you know, There's nothing ventured, nothing gained, or whatever you want to say. It's kind of weird because I'm seeing that, you know, there's certain people who are obviously using it quite a bit. But other people who are very active on Facebook or on maybe on Twitter, They're not really using Google Plus. I don't see them. I think it was like Damien Mulley, who we all know uses Facebook and Twitter a hell of a lot and is running the Social Media Awards again this year. I think he's only posted once.
On Google Plus, yeah.
Or maybe he's actually got up to twice now. But I mean, he'd had an account from the beginning and hadn't posted. It just sat there. I mean, that was, you know, there was nothing else, which is kind of strange in some ways, because you'd have thought that somebody like Damien would have, but no, he hadn't.
Damien's interesting, though. He's a reflective kind of approach, I think, to a lot of social media, and he uses it very actively, but you don't make the mistake of thinking he's someone who talks as much as he listens. He listens, observes, looks, and takes in an awful lot. In fact, I think I remember the early days of Twitter, now this is going back, but he had, if I recall correctly, back when there was only a handful of people on Twitter in Ireland, Damien appeared for a very long time, I don't know if you remember this, Michele, as not following anybody. And he was asked about this and he said he was simply, he subscribed to the RSS feeds of everybody in Google Reader or whatever aggregator that he was using. So he was watching it very, very closely. But if you looked at him in Twitter, you'd see that he wasn't actually following anybody, or at least something like that, I recall, at some stage in the early days of that. But speaking of Damien and the Social Media Awards, the Sockies is the hashtag for it. #SOCKIES. And the date is 17th of May, unless I'm very much mistaken, Michele. And there is a huge amount of sites and campaigns and various companies and individuals nominated for social media awards this year.
I mean, it's huge. I mean, I looked at the list, and I mean, there's a lot of companies and names on there that I wasn't familiar with. I mean, normally Damien breaks up those lists a bit into categories. But this time round, I mean, he's broken it up into six separate sets of categories.
Super categories.
Yes, he's got social media effectiveness, integrated and social media for elections. Then it was our PR, state bodies, mobile apps, customer care. Then he had social media sponsorship, innovative use. Then he had blogs and videos. And there was a bunch of Twitter categories and a bunch of Facebook categories. And like, there's, if you go through there, there's pretty much anything and everything you could think of, plus stuff you probably hadn't thought of in terms of categories.
Are you involved? Are you nominated? Are you sponsoring? What
now? Well, we entered. I mean, this is the thing as well, is that the first round of the nominations, people nominate themselves, because
of course
the way it works, apart from one or two categories, you'd have to nominate yourself, because you have to provide metrics about your social media activity as part of your entry.
So don't be shy. Go ahead and nominate yourself. But it's too late now. That stage is over, isn't it?
Yeah, that's gone. That deadline's gone. So now it goes into the entire judging phase. I'm not too sure how long that's going to take before we see any kind of shortlists.
Okay. The website of the Social Media Awards is socialmediaawards.com. Let's move on. Memo Lane, you wanted to talk about, Michele. Bringing back your social media memories. You said very cool concept, and I have to say I agree. There's a kind of a video that explains it all. Do you mind if I give that a run here?
Oh yeah, work away.
This is you, and these are the social media services you use. Your services are where you share your memories. Well, Memo Lane captures these memories and places them on a timeline so they're easy to look back on. It requires no extra effort because when you post activity to a service, your lane is automatically updated, like a scrapbook that writes itself.
So you can see also, here it's pulling together all your different services like Facebook or Twitter or YouTube or whatever it might be.
They went to the beach last week.
And whatever you post on a particular date, it kind of aggregates them. That's kind of the idea, isn't it? It'll aggregate.
Well, it's part of it. It's part of it. I mean, what I'm using, I signed up for it. I don't actually remember when I signed up for it. I get links to these things, sign up when they're in kind of, you know, beta or God knows what, or alpha or whatever. And then sometimes I get these emails into my inbox going, hey, you know, your account is now activated. I'm left scratching my head going, what the hell did I sign up for? I can't remember.
Yeah.
What I've got it doing is it sends me an email once a day with a memory or a set of memories, which is... It's a really, really weird but cool thing. So I'll get back, say, a few tweets I sent out, say, 2 years ago. Or it could be a few posts on Facebook or something I uploaded to Flickr or something I shared on some other social network. And this thing comes back into my inbox and I look and I go, oh, yeah, I remember that. Or maybe I look at it and go, what the hell was I thinking when I posted that? And it's this kind of... It's this kind of memory, digital memory thing that, you know, I've never understood why people would want to archive their tweets and all those things. So I look at it, it's like, you know, I posted it, deal with it. It's like a conversation. I don't record my conversations. Why would I want to record my tweets? But this thing kind of, it brings stuff back to you. It kind of helps you to, I don't know, relive a memory. It's a bit like kind of looking at snapshots from the past or something.
I'm astonished, and I don't even know how this is working. While we were talking just in the 2 minutes before we actually started the podcast this evening, I signed in and I gave it my Facebook. I signed in with Facebook Connect into this. Now, I'm not even sure. I guess, yes, I do have these sites linked in my Facebook profile, but it has pulled together my Irish language blog and podcasts from 2005, 2006. My Twitter feed going back to 2006, early 2007, I think I signed up with Twitter, first of all. Everything I posted on English blogs, Irish language blogs, the business website, various things. I'm actually astonished. I'm actually hugely impressed with this. And it's very, very stuff I bookmarked on God knows what. But there it is. It's all pulled in there together. I think stuff that I was feeding into Facebook at one stage or another. It's going back 5-6 years here, Michele, effortlessly.
Oh yeah, totally. And that's the thing. It's. I mean, see what I've seen with a few of these things. I think Google Plus has done it to a certain degree, and I've seen with a couple of the other ones where it'll kind of go, "Hey, we found this profile. We think it's you," and you kind of go, "Okay, that's a bit creepy, but that's kind of cool." You know,
but it is me. Pull it in.
Oh yeah. Go for it. And. Yeah, I mean, it brings in things, and you're just going, okay, right. You know, I completely forgot about that.
This is interesting now. This is actually very, very good. Memolane.com, and basically it aggregates all of the stuff you post to various things, and it pulls them together by date. And there's various sharing features and things like that involved in it as well. We will be back, I think, to try this out. It's definitely one of the most useful and one of the most intriguing ones that I've come across.
But then, I mean, but the question, of course, it raises. I mean, look, considering we were talking about Instagram, like how on earth do they make money?
Yeah, there's got to be some way.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is it. It's, you know, the computing resources required to run something like that must be significant.
I guess they're going to figure that out when they've got 30 million euro, dollar, 30 million users, I should say, and they can get... you see, this is the thing. You don't need to make money. You just flip it. Wait a second. This is real bubble talk now, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
That is one of the danger signs.
That's the thing. I mean, you know, is that the only reason for doing things, to be able to flip them later?
Speaking of $1 billion, Red Hat have announced that they've turned over $1 billion. They've reached that milestone. Red Hat, a company I think that went public back in, unless I'm very much mistaken, Michele, 98, 99 perhaps it might have been. There was a lot of talk about them at the time. They were the first Linux distribution to have an IPO. I remember myself, actually, we were just mentioning this before the show. In my job at the time, I worked for Dell. and I was involved in pre-installing Red Hat software. It was the first time that they installed software that wasn't by either Novell or Microsoft on Dell servers that we manufactured in Limerick, where I worked at the time. And it was a big deal at the time, pre-installing Red Hat Linux. I'm sure that everyone who got it wiped it and downloaded the latest distribution instead. But we went to the trouble of pre-installing it on their servers for them. And I actually visited Red Hat in Durham, North Carolina, around about 1998, 1999, and went over there for training at one stage. And it was kind of exciting. And then forgot all about them over the last 10, 12 years. But look at them now.
I think the figures that they produce, it's like they're on track for something like a billion in turnover. Mm. Now, they haven't actually quite, I don't think they've reached that yet. Yes, but what's really interesting is that it's an open source company.
Yeah.
It's open source technology. That means that, you know, a lot of people are using Red Hat technologies without paying license fees.
Exactly. But a lot of people are using it and paying for support. A lot of large enterprises, for example, are using it and they're paying for the kind of support they get from the kind of company that Red Hat is, which has they're paying for the fact, really, I suppose, that Red Hat, being involved in the development of open source Linux, has got major expertise in relation to that. And that's the expertise that they're selling on to companies who have invested heavily in Red Hat type infrastructure, and they trust it because it's open source. This is the major advantage, isn't it, of open source, that people feel, well, because it's open source, there aren't any surprises in there. There are a million eyeballs looking at this code, and you're more likely to find problems, and it's more likely to be more robust and more secure. And a lot of people didn't think that was true. People like Microsoft scoffed at the notion of open source software being a serious contender.
More than scoffed at them. I mean, they used to view it as being a major threat.
Yeah. Well, that's true.
I mean, they actually had a whole range. I think they had a whole bunch of ads and things that were going on about how, you know, it was the threat of open source.
Yeah.
This was some kind of evil thing. I mean, you know, it wasn't just a case of this is the competition. It's like, this is the competition. You need to be careful of them.
Yeah.
And yet at the same time, I think there was an announcement there, I think it was like in the last week or so, that Microsoft had contributed more to the Linux kernel than anybody else in the last year or something.
Oh, really?
I think it was something crazy like that. I'll have to do a quick search for that.
Yeah.
But it was one of these weird things. I mean, it's how things change. I mean, you know, you're talking about essentially free software and a company that only makes its money from, you know, selling support and professional services. Mm. Yeah, I found an article there. Microsoft tracks top 20 list of contributors.
That is interesting. Linux has definitely
one of the top 20 largest contributors. What is it? Let's see if we've got details of what it is. And it's to do with the Linux kernel. Where is it? Let's see. Not entirely by choice. Yeah, Hyper-V and things like that was where they put in a lot of the work.
Well, we say congratulations anyway to Red Hat. It's a milestone, I think, for them in particular and for Linux in general. And it's definitely, I think, a topic we're going to be coming back to again, Michele. There's lots more to talk about. But as we said, speaking of geeks and speaking of technology, you're hiring, Michele. You're looking for geeks.
I'm looking for geeks.
Yeah.
I'm looking for hardcore, dyed-in-the-wool geeks.
Very good.
So, I mean, what we've got at the moment is we've got a couple of openings, and there'll probably be more coming online in the next few weeks or months, depending on how things pan out. At the moment, we're looking for a senior Linux/Unix sysadmin engineer type. We're looking for several software engineer developers. And it's all, you know, these people need to have open source types. I mean, we're talking developers, you know, for Python, for PHP, knowledge of Bash, scripting, all that kind of stuff.
Sounds good. If people want to find out more, visit the website at blackknight.com. And you can also find there details of your latest offer, Michele. You're encouraging people to go mobile, or as it is in this case, go mobi.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the things we've been pushing a bit over the last couple of months. It's, you know, the mobile internet is growing and growing and growing. I mean, you remember, Colin, back in the mid-90s when we were told that was going to take off, WAP was going to be the saviour, and how mobile was going to be, you know, the thing, and it didn't happen.
That's right. And I mean, this software that you're offering, it's this mobile website builder. My first reaction when I look at this is kind of saying, hang on a second, we don't need to produce mobile versions of websites anymore now that we have iPads and smartphones and things like that. Or do we?
I'd say yes. And I mean, the thing is, it's down to a couple of things. I mean, first of all, a lot of people are accessing mobile sites on data plans. Mm. And if you don't have, you know, scaled down images, if you don't cut out a lot of the extra stuff, then it means that an average web page might be, I mean, I've seen up figures where they're saying like an average web page is up to 1 megabyte in size these days. So if you're on a lower end data plan, you could ease up your entire data allowance very, very quickly. Whereas if you've got a mobile optimized website, then the images are going to be smaller, it's going to load faster, the experiences overall is going to be better. And, you know, the thing is, there's lots of ways of doing mobile friendly. The thing with the GoMobi tool is it makes it easy, it makes it accessible, you don't need special skills, you can do it. It's not going to compete with, you know, the kind of job that a professional mobile developer might be able to do for you. That's a totally different conversation. This is to help, you know, your average user who doesn't have that kind of budget to get something up and running quickly.
Well, you can't argue with free for 30 days, Michele. So the thing to do really is to go in and try it out. And as you say, it works in two ways. You can either give it your existing site and it'll put you a long way towards making a mobile version of that, or indeed you can build a mobile site from scratch, and people can find out more about it, of course, on the website at blacknight.com.
Technology.ie is brought to you by Ireland's premier hosting and domain registration company, Black Knight. Black Knight offer a comprehensive range of hosting and domain solutions for businesses of all shapes and sizes, no matter where they are in the world.
You're listening to the Technology.ie podcast with Conor Muinichon and Michele Nealon. It's brought to you by Black Knight, of course, the company run by Michele in Carlow, County Carlow. Okay, you brought this up, Michele. ICANN, the report is that they have taken FAIL to a whole new level. What is this about? It's about the new generic top-level domains, isn't it?
Yeah, well, this it's one of these things. You know, I saw a few comments on Twitter and Facebook early this morning from people I knew who were involved with either applying themselves or helping other people to apply for new top-level domains.
And today was supposed to be the closing date.
Yeah, I mean, this is it. I mean, today is April 12th, 2012, and at 23:59 UTC on April 12th, the door was meant to close. That the application window was meant to shut. The online system that people were using for submitting their applications would be shut down, and that's it, game over. And, you know, because they had this entire process with you had to register on this online system before the end of last month, and then you had up until 23:59 UTC tonight to submit your completed application or applications. And now they've taken the entire application system offline, probably for up to 4 days, and they've extended the application window through till next Friday at 23:59. And the thing is, this isn't a free service. You know, applying for a new top-level domain is $185,000.
They're saying it's due to, they discovered technical issues. Today was supposed to be the deadline for it. They discovered some problems with the online submission system, the TLD application system, the TAS as they're calling it. And they've decided as a result of that to shut this down while they try and figure out what's wrong. And they've extended the closing date. It's reasonable enough, Michele, isn't it?
It is and it isn't. I mean, the part of the thing is this, is that, you know, you've got, if you think of it this way, right, let's say, you had you'd planned to apply for .com, okay? Well, actually, let's just use Black Knight as an easier one, because then I'm talking about myself and I can say something totally ridiculous and I can't sue myself.
Go ahead.
So let's say we were applying for .blacknight, and we'd submitted $185,000. That means, you know, that's a significant amount of money. Now, maybe we have to, we have the 185,000 is just the application fee. There's all sorts of other fees that you would have had associated with it, you know, drafting policies, liaising with back-end registry operators. There's a whole range of other costs.
But let's say you were ready to submit that today. You've taken it out of the bank. You're not earning interest on it. You were ready to submit that, and now it turns out that you can't submit it.
Well, this is it. You can't actually finalise your applications.
Yeah.
You can't log in. There's people I know that were working on this, and you know they'd originally thought, right, you know, that's that deadline. I can now actually get some sleep for a few days after this because you know they've been working around the clock finalising their applications, and now that entire thing's been thrown out of whack. But the other problem is a much more worrying one in some ways, is that you know ICANN as an organisation is demanding service level agreements of various entities. You know, yes. If they are the technical kind of overseer in many respects of the domain name system.
They're saying if you're going to run a top level domain, you better not be shutting it down for 4 days because you can't
exactly.
figure out what's
exactly. And yet they can't keep the application system online.
It's a bit amateurish, without a doubt. And
it's not good. It doesn't send the right kind of signal. I mean, I posted about it, and I was pretty vicious in my post. I mean, other people have posted about it in other blogs, and it's been picked up, of course, to the mainstream media. And you know, ICANN has stated that it isn't due to any cyber attack. One of the theories that I posited was that it was due in part to the system not being able to parse certain characters. It transpires that isn't the reason they took it offline. It's not clear why they took it offline. And the other thing that's a little bit, well, more than a little bit worrying is the lack of transparency as to why they took it offline. And the statement that they issued is, it's very, very vague. It's not clear, you know, is this going to come back up online, you know, tomorrow? Or is it going to be...
Yeah,
it's going to be Tuesday. I mean,
there's definitely going to have to be, I think, questions answered in relation to this, without a doubt. So we'll watch that with interest. Also of interest, it's been a while since we talked about .xxx, Michele, but you report that ICM, that's the company behind .xxx, have a whole load of other sexy top level domains that they want to register as well.
Yeah, they announced that earlier today, and it took me a bit by surprise. They're applying for .adult. .porn and .sex.
Right.
Now, I honestly don't know.
Have they filled up .xxx then? Have they used all the good names gone in .xxx?
Well, I don't know. It's an interesting move.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know, there could be any number of reasons. I mean, it could be a genuine play, but at the same time, you know, I can't see those applications going smoothly because I mean, there was so much heated debate and so much controversy around .xxx with, you know, some governments saying, you know, that's it, we're going to block everything. And even companies such as ourselves, we got quite a bit of flack in the media because we said we were going to offer .xxx. Mm. You know, let's say .porn launches in the morning. Would I want to publicly state that we supported .porn?
Would you?
Well, you have met me, so I probably would. But that's not the thing. I mean,
the question is to whether or not the demand is there for this. And as again, when we talk about what it costs to actually invest in a new generic top level domain, you'd wonder is this really well? It really gives you an insight into the value, I suppose, of the online adult industry if they consider that an investment in for example, these three new generic top level domains would actually be worthwhile.
Well. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, the thing is, how, you know, .xxx had launched a few months ago. There has been uptake, yes, but it hasn't exactly been stellar. It hasn't been hitting those massive figures that we saw with the launch of .co. Like .co, I think there is over 2 million names at this stage, which is, you know, which is pretty damn impressive. Whereas .xxx, I think it's hovering around the 200,000 or 300,000 mark.
That's quite low in many ways, and we're several months into that now at this stage. You also report that they say they're going to grandfather any registrants of .XXX domains into the other new extensions for free, which kind of, well, that seems bizarre in a way. If the reason was that all the good names were gone in .XXX, well, they're automatically taking them up in .adult, .porn, .sex as well. So that can't really, that doesn't really explain that either, does it?
Well, there is a logic behind that one. I mean, the logic there, I mean, it works on multiple levels. I mean, apart from anything else, if they were to open up a new adult top-level domain, then they would come under fierce attack from a lot of the adult industry, kind of saying, hey, what the hell? You expect us to go off and, you know, protect our brand in another 3 TLDs? Are you crazy? Are you mad? Whatevers. And, you know, there'll be lots of court cases. The other thing is it can kind of add value to the existing .XXX investment that somebody's made. Because, I mean, .XXX is not a cheap domain. Yeah. It's downright expensive.
It's over $100, isn't it, to register one, isn't it?
Sorry?
It's over $100?
It depends who you get them through. I mean, we're doing them for, I think, around €99 or thereabouts, which makes us, we're not one of the cheapest. But then at the same time, why would we be? I mean, you know, it's the wholesale cost on them is significantly higher. I mean, they're nearly 10 times the cost of, say, a .biz.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how this pans out, as we say, over the next several weeks.
Well, they'll get plenty of PR out of it anyway. If nothing else, it'll get them plenty of PR.
What is the... and it's funny, actually, from what I've noticed of some of the .XXX publicity that's going on, they have a kind of a Ryanair approach, don't they, to it? No stunt is too cheap.
Yeah, there is a certain degree of that. I mean, you know, ultimately, it's us, the registrars, who should probably be pushing it and pushing it harder than anybody else.
Yeah.
No pun intended.
Indeed.
We're talking about XXX.
Okay, let's move on. What's the next big deadline, by the way? So this has been put back, as we say, the deadline until 20th of April. When will we start to find out whether some of these GTLD extensions will have succeeded or not? Or what's the next thing we'll hear about them?
Originally, what was meant to happen is they were meant to have what people were calling the big reveal.
Yeah.
And the big reveal basically is the day when ICANN publishes the full list of applications that they've received. So you'd see, you know, how many companies have applied for .blog, how many of companies have applied for .web, and then, of course, there's all the other ones. And that was meant to be, originally they were talking about the 1st of May. Then they issued a statement there, I think it was last week, maybe the week before, saying that it would be something like the 29th of April. But they also said in that statement that the big reveal date was meant to be 2 weeks after the closure of the application window. So if the application window pushed out 8 days, then one would assume that the big reveal is going to be pushed out by about 10 days as well.
Okay, so we'll wait and see what happens with that. Finally, Michele, on this week's technology.ie podcast, I've saved the best till last. And as a Windows lover, or even an Ubuntu lover, I'm happier with either of those, I have to say, than I am with Mac. I take a certain smug satisfaction out of this story. Flashback Trojan and a botnet with how many? 600,000 infected Macs?
Yeah. It's not good.
Wow.
I would not like to be working in Apple's PR department at the moment.
But Michele, people have been saying for years that, okay, you know, one of the things is, right, there are less Macs, I suppose, in use than Windows machines, which means that the people who develop these viruses and Trojans are going to go for the low-hanging fruit and look for one of these. But really, Mac users have almost claimed that Macs are inherently more secure than Windows. This is not true, is it?
Well, no, it's one of those things. It's like saying Linux is more secure than Windows. You know, the key thing has always been it was always easier to write viruses and other badware to target Windows machines.
Because there are so many more of them out there and so many people using them I suppose a lot of maybe perhaps less educated, less technologically educated users perhaps using a Linux machine and you know, having
Windows poor practices. Machine, I presume.
I beg your pardon, using a Windows machine and having poor security practices in place. You know, it's a lot easier to build up a big botnet of Windows machines. But really, there hasn't been this with Mac, and now there is.
Yeah, and that is worrying. I mean, I use Mac. All my machines are Macs, and all the machines I used to have are Macs. We won't talk about that. No, I mean, it is worrying. I mean, there was a flash one. There was another hole that they found in the Java that they had on the Macs, and you know that nice honeymoon period where you know Macs became more popular, yet we're still perceived as being more secure. Hey, it's over.
It's over now, without a shadow of a doubt.
The party is over. The fat lady has sung. I mean, whatever analogy you want to use.
Do you use antivirus, Michele, on your Macs?
I do to a certain degree, but it's one of these odd things because most of the antivirus software that I've tried out on Macs has been horrible. I mean, it's the kind of thing that it doesn't sit nicely in the background and do its funky thing like you'd expect it to do. It kind of comes along and takes over the machine completely and is kind of beating you over the head, which isn't particularly helpful.
I have to say, I think I've mentioned to you before, I'm a reluctant Mac user. I only have the one. It's the one I use when I'm actually talking to you. But I don't do any real work on it, Michele. It's the one we use in the studio. We browse fairly static kind of content on it, really. And we do a small bit of audio processing on it. All of the real work we do around here is on Windows machines, I suppose out of habit and choice, and because we use Adobe software for our video and audio processing as well.
But you can use some Adobe software on Windows or on Mac.
You can recently, I think, isn't that right? But I mean, it's more of the legacy, I think, has been more that Audition and Premiere and those were only traditionally available for Windows, but I know they're available for Mac now as
they're,
well.
They're all available for they've always been available for both.
Have they? I didn't realize that. No, yeah.
No, you're actually, I have to correct you.
I'm wrong.
No, you're wrong.
Yeah, okay.
And the thing is this, which is interesting, when you buy most of the Adobe desktop software, your license covers you for either Windows or Mac.
Right.
Talking of Adobe, they're bringing out a major upgrade to their CS suite. I think it's in June, possibly. And if you buy any of the software between now and the end of May, you automatically qualify for a free upgrade.
Well, I'm definitely going to be looking at that. So the point I wanted to make, as I say, is that I use the Mac so little, I must confess, I don't have antivirus on the Mac at all whatsoever. But I do on Windows. At the moment, I'm using AVG, not the free version of it, but whatever the paid version of it is. And I've got to say, it's very unobtrusive, but only because, and I think this goes for all antivirus software, Michele, once you get into downloading your email into a mail client, and because I use webmail almost absolutely exclusively now at the moment, I find that it's a lot easier. But definitely when you're logging in, connecting to Pop or IMAP or something like that, and downloading let's say a dozen emails with attachments, that's when I have found antivirus really gets stuck in the middle and everything grinds to a halt.
Well, it can do, but I mean, it doesn't have to. I mean, it's one of these things. I mean, if you're using, I mean, it depends what you're using, obviously. But if you were using our business email, you'd have that scanning built in.
On the server side?
Of course.
Yeah. So you could turn it off on the client side?
Well, you know, there's always going to be a risk.
Yeah.
Because this is one of the things that, you know, discover that, you know, virus writers, you know, their success, in inverted commas, is obviously going to be to get ahead of the antivirus writers.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, you will find sometimes that, you know, software company X, their antivirus engine might pick up on something a couple of hours ahead of software company Y. And if somebody ever said to me, "Hey, can I turn it off on the desktop?" I'd go, "No, don't." Because I mean, the thing with the desktop as well is you're not just protecting your email; you're also protecting a whole load of other things. I mean, it can be Adware and all these other kind of things.
I agree, and I would say leave that turned on, but in my experience it has been that the scanning of downloaded emails and attachments is something that certainly it depends on, and it's something I've seen with people on dial-up connections and things like that,
we've seen that where, let's say, you know, people are ringing us up going, oh, you know, my email's not working. And it turns out that they might be using some desktop antivirus,
yeah,
which would change. It sets up like a local proxy.
Yeah.
So if you go into the POP and IMAP and SMTP settings,
yeah,
they're completely different.
Michele, there's a school of thought out there which says that savvy users can do without antivirus. You got to have your wits about you, and you just know not to click on this or that, or don't touch anything that looks suspicious, and behave with a little bit of common sense. Would you subscribe to that?
No.
No.
No, categorically no. I mean, the thing with around security, and I mean, unfortunately, between...
And obviously, of course, you've got to have all your updates. You know, you got to patch your software in that as well. But no, go ahead, yeah?
No, I mean, the thing is, you know, unfortunately, because of the line of work I'm in, and, you know, various things that have happened both to me personally and to the company over the last few months, I've become very, very conscious of... what's the best word to use? How apathy or overconfidence can be your undoing. And, you know, it's all very well to say, Ari, you know, I'd never fall for that, or these things, they're aimed at stupid people who whatever, or somebody who isn't that technical, or, you know, there's a lot of things you can say to rationalize not doing certain things. But, you know, the reality is, we're all human. We're all fallible. You know, we do forget things. We don't lock ourselves out of machines. We'll click on links without thinking about it because it comes from a trusted source.
So every layer of defense, you're saying, Michele, is worth bearing in mind, and it's a belt and braces approach.
Totally. I mean, yeah. It's just, you know, that kind of thing. Oh, you know, I'm the super duper user. I mean, I remember in the office we had a guy. Who considered himself to be, you know, very computer savvy and everything else, and his work laptop got infected. I mean, you know, it's like, what? I mean, hello?
Was that you, Michele? Tell the truth now.
What?
Was that you? Was that really yourself?
No, I don't bring my laptop into the office.
Michele,
I can't bring my laptop into the office anymore since the damn thing was stolen.
I know. Tell us, what should people do if they think they might have this, if they don't have antivirus on their Mac?
Well, there's a couple of the antivirus companies are offering tools which you can download and you can run them on your computer just to see if you are infected. And if you are infected, you know, it'll remove it. You know, these kind of, it's a single purpose removal tool.
I'll definitely be in the market for that. Is there, and we'll put a few links as well into the notes on technology.ie in relation to that. Is there one off the top of your head that you'd recommend?
Somebody sent me a link earlier today. Let me just, I think it was F-Secure might have had one.
I think so as well. I heard that.
Yeah, I think if Secure had one, which is pretty simple. It wasn't a particularly large file. Downloaded it, unzipped it, ran it, and it ran the scan. A couple of seconds and it's done. And luckily I was good. I was fine. There were no problems.
Well, I'll be downloading that just after the show now and check out my own Mac. I'll post later and let you know how I got it.
Well, the other thing to do, Con, is like, you know, if the software update on the Mac, I think, runs automatically about once a week or so.
Yeah.
And if it hasn't run, you can run it directly yourself. Just go up to the top left, click on your Apple icon, go down to software update and let it run.
Okay.
And you know, if the machine hasn't run it in the last week or so, it's going to run at least one update for Java.
Because this vulnerability has been patched now, hasn't it?
Well, the Java one has been, but the thing is, I could be wrong, but it looks to me like they may have released two Java updates in the last week.
Okay, because this was exploiting multiple vulnerabilities, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, but the thing with Apple is the way when they publish. Security notices, they're intentionally quite vague.
Yeah.
Well, this, in the world of security, I mean, this is the thing that people kind of forget is, you know, if Apple were to give more details, that would cause more problems than it would solve.
Do you think?
Well, you see, the thing is this. It's like, if you know what the vulnerabilities are, then you're going to go looking for them.
But Apple have been criticised, really, haven't they, for the kind of slowness of their response to this. And they don't have the same kind of experience of dealing with this kind of stuff that Microsoft do.
Well, yeah, I mean, there is a certain thing. I mean, it's part of the kind of the cult of Mac. I mean, they, you know, there's certain things around their communications that aren't exactly, well, stellar, let's just say. But at the same time, I work in an industry and I deal with a lot of people in the security space where, you know, there's a lot of stuff that goes on behind the scenes that, you know, normal people, you're not going to be aware of until much, much, much later. Mm. So, like, you know, the thing is, you know, some of the big security stories involving the DNS, the mainstream media might pick up on us a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks after industry insiders have already been dealing with it. Because, you know, you need to have the time to actually resolve the issue before you go public about exactly what the issue is. And I mean, sure, there is an argument, and it does have a certain validity about, you know, the entire transparency. But, you know, it's, you know, you have to get that balance right. You have to allow people the opportunity to go back and patch their systems and make it right.
Well, listen, Michele, thanks for joining us on the technology.ie podcast. As always, we'll do it again hopefully next week, and I'll talk to you then.
All right, thanks, Colin.